Our special guest tonight, Robert Schneck, as we're talking about his latest work, The Bye-Bye Man, but we're going to talk about all his works, Strange, Strange Stories. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Robert Schneck with us. We're going to be talking about some of his fascinating stories, but we'll take your calls and your stories too. Robert, you've got a different perspective about Bigfoot. What is that?
Yes. Before I say it, though, George, the miracle drug of the 1970s for cancer was interferon.
Ah, yes, I remember that.
Yeah, I had to look in the book to find it. Well, I was really interested in, as far as Bigfoot goes, I have always loved Bigfoot. That's always been one of my favorite aspects of paranormal, cryptozoology. I love that. And there was one story that always stuck in my mind, and that was Ape Canyon, which everyone who's into Bigfoot, a lot of older people who are into Bigfoot all know the story of Ape Canyon, which was that a man named Fred Beck and several of his friends and relatives, they were working as miners near Mount St. Helens, and they built a cabin in the mountain, near the mountain, and one night they shot at what looked like a big hairy man in the woods, and they claimed that that night they were attacked by Bigfoots who bounced rocks off the walls and scared them out of their claim. I was always fascinated by this story because anyone who's read the account that Fred Beck wrote of it knows that his own perspective was very unusual. He did not think Bigfoot was a normal animal. He thought it was a manifestation from a different plane of existence. He was a spiritualist, and he had some unusual ideas. But what I found so interesting about his story was the way it resembled traditional magical treasure hunting. There is a long tradition in the United States of people that would go treasure hunting at night. It seemed like every town had its legend about pirates' gold or some miser who supposedly left a treasure chest in the cellar of an abandoned building, or there was gold buried in the cemetery or something like that. Every town seemed to have a story like that. And it was not unusual for people to go looking for it. And the way they went looking for it was using magic. And there were all different kinds of spells. You would draw a circle, and you would use a dowsing rod or something to find the gold, or you would summon a spirit. Now, what I found so interesting about all this and how it relates to Bigfoot is that there was always the problem of when you got to the treasure, when you buried down to the treasure, something would go wrong. Usually the spell that you cast to keep away the protectors of the treasure, you'd break the spell by speaking.
Huh.
And a monster would appear and drive all the treasure hunters away. What I found so interesting about Fred Beck's story was that they thought they had used spiritualism to do prospecting. They used they summoned spirits to lead them to their gold mine. And just as they felt they were on the verge of finding gold, these monsters, Bigfoot, appeared and drove them from their gold. At the same time, there's another famous story from the same year of a man who was prospecting in Canada in the Toba Inlet. And he claims that while he was prospecting, he was carried off by Bigfoot. Now, what these two stories have in common is that Bigfoot was protecting gold. And we don't know that that was his motivation, but that's the way it worked out. This group was prevented from finding their gold mine by a bunch of Bigfoots, and this man was prevented from finding his gold mine by a family of Bigfoot. Now, there is a little bit of this running through Bigfoot lore, this idea of this connection between Bigfoot and gold mines. And if you look at traditional belief, it used to be that when somebody would see a ghost or a monster, a lot of people believe that, well, if they saw a ghost or a monster, that means there's a buried treasure there. You know who also got me thinking about this? You know Linda Godfrey.
Yeah, real well. She's been on the show many times.
Linda pointed out in one of her books that there is a connection between the sightings of the werewolf-type monsters that she specializes in and Indian mounds. Well, Indian mounds are one of the places where people were always digging for treasure. So here we've got another connection between monsters, seemingly guardian monsters, and treasure. At least people believing that there was treasure there. So I just think that that's an aspect, a traditional aspect that people have forgotten about, but is worth looking at again, this idea that maybe monster sightings are connected to buried treasure. I'm not saying
that. Interesting take.
It's just, like I said, it's just a different point of view, and it's something that people might think about. I'm not suggesting that everyone go out with a metal detector when, you know, at the next Bigfoot sighting, but if you look at the tradition of monster hunting, if you look at the tradition of monster sightings, rather, not monster hunting, if you look at the tradition of monster sightings, they are connected to hidden gold, hidden treasure, and they're the guardians of it. So like I said, it's just another aspect of it that's worth considering.
All right, let's take some calls, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the strange Bye Bye Man book. Let's go to Jay in Flora Home, Florida, to get things started. Go ahead, Jay.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I had some comments, and then leading up to my question. First, I wanted to say, going back to the Ouija board, there's a video on YouTube that goes back as far back as they can with the origins and history of it, and it reveals the entire cursed, tragic past of it. And it's very telling. There's a lot to that. Where he was talking about the clowns, I think one of the reasons that brought back in such popularity was a couple seasons ago on American Horror Story, Freak Show.
Freak Show, that's right.
One of the main characters was the killer clown. And I went to Fantasy Fest in Key West last year, and the theme was All Hallows Intergalactic Freak Show. So they had that as a major theme, and there were lots of clowns dressed up. I wanted to point out, and I was going to say this before if I got through on Friday the 13th, that Friday the 13th and Halloween or the night before, and including Christmas Eve, those are all satanic holidays, okay? And there's a documentary, I believe it's called 666 Revealed, and it used to be on Netflix. It's on a couple other apps that if you have Roku or anything like that, I can't think of it offhand. And it basically explores the history of how many of the notorious killers and mainly serial killers were all born on different satanic holidays. The urban legend that scared me the most, especially when I was a kid, after kids around the neighborhood told me, was Bloody Mary.
Yes.
And then especially with Bloody Mary and then seeing Candyman very young, both of those being similar. And I was wondering if there was actually any true origin and facts to the legend of Bloody Mary.
Do you know about that case, Robert?
Well, I know about the legend of Bloody Mary. We had it too when I was a kid, and the idea was that you would. We didn't call her Bloody Mary, actually. For some reason, we called her Mary Worth, like the comic strip. And the idea was that if you went into a room and turned off all the lights and looked in the mirror and recited her name a certain number of times, or kept saying her name until your vision blurred, that Mary's face would appear in the mirror, and she would reach out and do something to you, scratch your face, or worse, strangle you, or something like that. I have heard different origins of the legend, that there was supposedly a woman who was hanged as a witch, and they called her Bloody Mary and all that. But I don't think anyone's ever really tracked down the origin of that story. It's very well known and very popular, though. And there's a long tradition of summoning spirits using mirrors.
Indeed. And it seems like the Bloody Mary story pops up around Halloween a lot, doesn't it?
Well, sure. It's a common party game, and it's like a lot of things. It's a bit of a rite of passage. You and your friends dare each other to try it, and you go into the bathroom and you have an occult experience, or you just scare the heck out of each other.
What is it about mirrors and things that are so scary?
Well, they appear to be a doorway to a different place, and they look like something. You know, that's a big question, George, and it's, you know, I don't really want to go into it because it's such a big question, but mirrors are also like ponds, which are also a doorway to the underworld, and, you know, they reflect, you can see through them, and there's something bizarre about seeing our world reflected. And I think that has a lot to do with it. Also, you know, mirrors are a fairly recent appearance. They hardly existed until the 17th century. So they were always looked at with a bit of awe.
They have said that if you stare in a mirror in a dimly lit room, that you might even hallucinate.
Yes. Yeah, I've done that myself a little bit.
It's weird, isn't it?
What happened? I get eye fatigue. And my face starts to blur and things like that. So it's an odd experience.
Okay, let's go next to Robert in the city of New York. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is a great show.
This is fun.
Let me ask your guest two questions.
Sure.
Questions. One on serial killers. How far back does your historical research go? I want to mention two specific ones that you may be familiar with. One was a Breton Frenchman named Gilles de Rais. 15th century, I believe, he is supposed to have killed up to maybe 140, 200 children. The second one is my favorite, Countess Elizabeth Báthory. Are you familiar with the Hungarian mad woman?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the blood countess.
Yes, the blood countess who wanted to stay young forever. And so she lured dozens, hundreds of people to her castle, and with the help of her servants, she had them killed and mixed their blood with milk, because she believed, like many others, that she would remain eternally young. She may have been one of the influences for Stoker, for Dracula. Are you familiar with either of those two?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm very familiar with them. Some people say Gilles de Rais is also the origin of Bluebeard. And
the pirate?
No, Bluebeard, the fairy tale, the man who marries a beautiful young woman, even though he has this terrible reputation as having killed all of his wives, and he tells her, he gives her keys to every room in the castle.
But she's special, right?
Yeah, don't ever use this key. Don't ever go into this room. So the minute he leaves the house, the first
thing
he
does, that's where she goes.
That room, opens the door, and there she sees the heads of all of his previous wives hanging there from the ceiling. She drops the key, it gets a blood stain on it, and she can't wash it off. And when Bluebeard comes back, he realizes what she's done, and he kills her, and she joins the dead
You end up seeing her head in there.
Yeah, yeah, that's one version of the story. But some people think Gilles de Rais is the origin of the Bluebeard legend. I don't know if it's true or not, but that is a belief.
And what about the Countess?
The Countess is controversial. Some people say, for example, that she was certainly a murderess, and she did certainly murder her. She was incredibly cruel to her servants. Whether she did the actual bathing in blood, though, that's a bit of a question, because there is a long tradition in European and Middle Eastern folklore of people revitalizing themselves by bathing in blood. In fact, in Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist, the last chapter in the book was on a practice that I had never heard of until I wrote the book, of people that were suffering from tuberculosis or poor health in general during the 19th century, that they would go to slaughterhouses and drink the blood of freshly slaughtered cows. And this was believed to help give them strength, improve their health, help them deal with the tuberculosis. This was so common that it seemed to be going on in slaughterhouses throughout the United States. And I was doing a book panel once with a lady who was psychic. And after we all gave our presentations, she told me that her father had worked in a slaughterhouse, probably in the 1970s, and there were still people that did that. There were still people that came in who were in poor health and wanted to drink the freshly killed animal's blood to help them improve their health.
They really think that works.
Yeah, that is a very ancient belief. It goes over. There are ancient Hebrew stories about Pharaoh murdering children so he could bathe in their blood, and it would help him cure leprosy. It would cure his leprosy. There were stories of when kings would get old or sick. Anytime a child disappeared, they said it was because the children were being abducted and their blood being given to the king to help to save his life. Usually an unpopular king. But these stories are very common. And again, compare that to the stories we were talking about earlier of children being abducted in Atlanta to make life-saving medication. You know, this is a very basic belief.
Let's go to Martin in Cocoa Beach, Florida. First-time caller. Hello, Martin. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, George. It's a pleasure to speak with you and your guest.
Thank you.
My brother-in-law turned me on to you shortly after you took over the show, and I don't think that I've ever had an opportunity to really add anything to the conversation, so I've never called. But this particular show, I was born and raised in Gallia County, Ohio, Gallup Bluffs, which sits right across the river from Henderson and Point Pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mothman is a very well-covered topic. People's heard about it forever. But it seems like most of the sightings were over around the old CMT area in Henderson. But back in the 70s, there was a group of us, maybe 16 to 18 years old, in that area. We would always go up to an abandoned strip mine area at night. We'd build a fire, and there was a big pond there, and we'd party, and, we would. But one night we were up there, and there had to be at least 18 to 25 of us. And we actually saw what is considered to be the Mothman.
Jeez.
And it come out from the east direction, which would be the Ohio River, from the Henderson side.
It was flying, right?
Yes, it was flying. It was probably maybe 100 feet off the ground where it was clearly visible. It circled our group three times, but we had no problem seeing it.
Did it look like a bird, or what did it look like?
Well, it's hard to explain because it seemed to have wings, but at the same time, it was, I couldn't really say it was wings. From our distance, it seemed like it would be anywhere from 6 to 9 foot, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It circled our group three times and then went back east the way it came from.
But it did not look like a bird, did it?
No, it didn't. And what was funny is that there had been so many sightings recently that the newspapers actually were trying to claim, and this is the truth, that there was a California condor that had flown too far east, and that's what everybody was seeing.
Interesting excuse, but that was probably one of the greatest stories, Mothman, ever. Was it not, Robert?
I think so. I mean, I was weaned on the Mothman prophecies. I still remember as a small child, it was one of the few books on the paranormal that was in the public library, and I read it cover to cover.
It's a great story. Robert, we're going to come back and take some final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Michael Cremo joins us talking about some incredible work of the forbidden archaeologist, and then we'll have open lines on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come back in a moment with Robert Schnack, as we talk about his work, the Bye-Bye Man, we'll take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Robert Schnack with us, the Bye-Bye Man. Robert, let's talk about the Haunted House Project. What is that?
That is a long-term project that a friend of mine and I started many years ago. He had a theory that if you took haunted houses and examined them, that there might be a connection between how the house was laid out, how the house was actually built, its dimensions, its size, its materials, that there could be a connection between that and haunting. And he had this idea that if we measured enough haunted houses, did a really thorough job of it, that we might be able to discover some common characteristics. And I thought from that, well, if that was possible, and I had some problems with that because I didn't think it would quite work, but if that was possible, why don't we use that information to build a haunted house deliberately? But I was uncomfortable with the idea of his approach because I thought there were too many parameters. It was just too many possibilities for that to be successful. So I thought, what if instead of doing that, we took every traditional element of haunting, a piece of land that was the site of a battle or a murder, if we took timber and bricks and all these from the places where people had committed suicide or there had been a disaster or there had been murders, if we had taken those and used those to build a house on, let's say, a place with underground streams and an old cemetery and all that, and you know, all the old traditional elements, and then put a family inside to see what would happen. And the funny thing is that towns, I have a fascination with houses where things happened, bad things. And a lot of towns will destroy the houses where multiple
right.
murders have happened.
Now, nobody wants to buy them, right?
No one wants to buy them. They want the thing removed.
But to me, the ground is just as bad.
It could very well be. But, you know, it's interesting. There was one particularly awful murder serial killer. I don't want to go into him. He's so disgusting. But his house was between... It was just a normal suburban house mm-hmm. between two other houses. And the owner of the house was so disgusted with it that what he did was he destroyed the house and simply divided the property between the next-door neighbors. So it's like that piece of property no longer exists. It's been wiped out. The only thing that exists anymore is a little sidewalk run up to it.
But the ground is still there.
It's still there.
And it's always going to be there.
Yeah, well, my idea was that what if we took those materials when they knocked down these houses, collected them, and used them to build another house? Would it be possible to deliberately create a haunting? And if you have a family, let's say, or a group of people that are living there, this could almost be a reality show when you think about it. If you take a group of people like that who know the history, is it possible that a group of people working together can begin to create phenomena? You know, that was one of the possibilities of the Bye Bye Men, that these three people working together were able to, by themselves, through psychokinesis or some other form of ESP, through themselves create the phenomena because they believed it could happen. Which is always an interesting aspect of this stuff. Like, do ghost hunters, when something happens, is it a ghost doing it, or is it the ghost hunters themselves doing it through psychokinesis?
Or a combination of both.
Exactly. I mean, there are so many possibilities. The idea of, oh, it's a ghost, which is a disembodied being, blah, blah, blah. There are other possibilities, and they're very interesting.
Let's take a few more calls, and we'll continue chatting. We'll go to Mike in West Palm Beach, Florida here. Michael. Hey, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah. I've been noticing the last few months that the face of Donald Trump has been changing. I started doing research on this other death, and it's called shape-shifting.
He's shape-shifting, huh?
Okay. Now, what does it mean? The story is that this guy is really a reptile or a lizard. Well, you're laughing, okay.
Like chuckling.
They're using shape-shifting to make a human face, but it's not working. There are mistakes being made. And over the last few months, if you go to YouTube, there's documentaries, photographs of this.
Well, you know what? It's been told, David Icke thinks that the Bush family and the Queen, of course, and her family, that they are reptilians as well, that there's this bloodline, this heritage and bloodline. I don't know. Robert, what do you think?
That's above my pay grade.
All right, but it is in my pay grade, and it's weird. I don't know if Donald is a reptilian or not.
George, would you mind if I asked your listeners a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I'm collecting material for a new book. And there's something that I find very interesting, and I'm hoping that somebody might have had an experience with this. You know, a lot of people brought home human relics from World War II, Japanese skulls, things like that. And I'm curious if any of your listeners know of a family member or themselves who had a strange experience connected to these skulls or other human relics that were brought back.
How would you like them to contact you?
If they can, my email is robertdamonschneck@gmail.com.
All right, back to Trump for a little bit. I will admit he's either got a bad suntanning machine or something, because he's got these white raccoon eyes.
Yeah, well, have you ever seen those little things they put on their eyes when they climb into the tanning booth?
Yeah, those goggles to protect your eyes.
I think that must be what that is. I was wondering about that, too.
Well, he should, you know, blush it in with makeup or something like that, kind of mesh it in a little bit. Let's go to Samira in the state of Washington, first-time caller. Hi, Samira.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. Go ahead.
Okay, so I have, like, three questions.
Let's do one at a time.
I wanted to know your guys' take on the Pleiadians. And then also, I believe that, like, for example, how we manifested Bigfoot, I think that, well, part of the conspiracy is that humans as a collective consciousness are powerful enough to manifest literally anything. If we're all focused on one thing at one time, that it will literally, like, manifest itself, like, out of thin air.
Poof, like that.
Yes.
All right, the Pleiadians probably above your pay grade again there, Robert.
Well, let me say, George, there are three things I don't write about because they are too big for me. UFOs and ETs, the Kennedy assassination, and Roswell. They are all too complicated for me.
All right.
I feel like such a novice when someone brings up any of those subjects.
What do you think of Bigfoot being some kind of dimensional creature?
I have, let's say that the idea is interesting. It would certainly explain why people can see these things for year after year after year without anything physical ever coming from it. That was certainly Fred Beck's idea. I have trouble wrapping my mind around it. It's really, you know, this is kind of a funny thing, George. Some people, maybe they think I'm a bit of a coward when it comes to this, but I focus on the historical aspect of the paranormal and people's beliefs about it. My own beliefs are kind of, you know, the Freudian idea is that everything's partially true, everything's partially false, and it's always changing. And if anything was true, it wouldn't stay true for long. And that's kind of the way I view things.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, let's go to her last question. Samira, go ahead.
Okay, and then I just also wanted to say or ask you that if you're ever in Seattle or the next time you are, if you would go out on a date with me. And Tom knows what I look like, so you can get the thumbs up from him.
I would be flattered, Samira.
I think she was asking me, Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It could have been you, too. Who knows? Who knows?
Oh, that's true. Oh, anyway, if I show up, I'm available.
So, Robert, let's talk, before we go back to final calls, the God Machine. What's that?
God Machine. The God Machine was something that a minister built in 1851. He went from a universalist minister to a spiritualist minister. And he felt that his name was the Reverend John Murray Spear, and he was famous in anti-slavery circles because he preached against slavery before others did. So he sometimes got beat up by mobs and things like that. But when he converted to spiritualism, he began to get constant revelations from the spirits. And one of these revelations was that a machine could be built that would become a sort of a mechanical messiah, that he could use, that it would become the new mode of power. Motive, M-O-T-I-V-E, power, was one of the ways he referred to it. And it would be alive and a machine and a sort of a god It was actually, John Murray Spear was not the clearest thinker in the world, or at least he didn't explain it that clearly, but he began to receive these instructions on how to build this God machine. And he had a small group of followers in Lynn, Massachusetts, and they went to this cabin on a mountain, actually a big rock that they have there outside of Lynn. And for several months, they would receive these revelations, and they built this little sort of a machine that was made out of gems and precious metals and pieces of metal that had been machined for very specific purposes. And supposedly, one of his female followers, became not pregnant, but she became pregnant with the spirit that would enter into this machine. And she went through all the birth pains, and supposedly this machine that they built came to life for a little while, but it didn't last, whatever it happened to it. And they spent a fortune building this thing, and they finally got discouraged, and supposedly it was moved to a place in New York State where a bunch of farmers were offended by it, and they smashed it.
They smashed it?
They smashed it, yeah. That's the story that he told, anyway. And supposedly the pieces of it, he saved the pieces of it, and they were preserved at this little spiritualist utopia he built. Oh gosh, I think it was in New York State. Yeah, it was in New York State in the burned over district.
Did the Bye Bye Man have another name besides Bye Bye Man? Did he have an actual human name?
No name.
Never did.
They never revealed a name. It's just that if you think of the Bye Bye Man or you think of Gloomsinger, either one of those names does the trick. That turns you into the beacon.
As you said, you don't use Ouija boards. I don't use Ouija boards, but a lot of people do, Robert.
Yes.
They like them. What do you recommend that they do?
I recommend they don't use Ouija boards. I don't see that much good ever comes from them. I'm not going to tell anyone that they're going to be damned to hell forever if they use a Ouija board or anything like that.
But they might be.
But, well, yes. There's certainly people that do believe that. I would say that you are probably, this is what I think is happening, is that you are accessing parts of your own mind, and it might not be pleasant. There, you know, remember that it's your own mind that also creates nightmares and scares you to death, can scare you half to death in your sleep. Well, there are parts of your mind that you don't consciously know about, and they can come out through the Ouija board. You know, the Ouija board is a form of automatic writing, and psychologists, in the early days of psychology, they would encourage their patients to do automatic writing in order to access these parts of the mind. Well, there are parts of the mind that are pretty unpleasant, and they can come through in the Ouija board.
What is it about the mindset of a serial killer, Robert? I mean, what possesses them to do what they do? I've got to believe that this happened when they were kids, infants. Something happened to them.
You know, George, I originally I was kind of taken in by the romantic literary view of them, like the Hannibal Lecter stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I read about them, the more repelled I became by them, because, frankly, they just do it because it makes them happy. There is nothing more to it that I can figure out. These are nasty, sadistic, small-minded, shallow people whose only pleasure in life comes out of hurting someone else. And when I started realizing that, I developed this contempt for them that I've never really gotten over. They repulse me more than anything else. And it's a shame, too, because there's one of them who claims to have had an experience with a Bigfoot, who claims to have seen Bigfoot. And I'd like to write to him, but I can't bring myself to do it.
All right. We take text questions, of course. Tom, you've got one for us.
Hey, Robert, this is from Gina in Louisville. And she wants to know, what is it that really makes you fearful in life?
I am terrified of, I have several phobias. Like a lot of writers, I'm extremely neurotic. I'm not going to say those phobias because someone will think it's funny to do it to.
But you do get scared.
Oh, yeah, very easily. I've got a lot of fears, and I don't want to talk about them on a major radio show.
Should we press you for it? No, we won't. We won't. How many times is this a phobia? You get in your car, it's nighttime, and you really think someone's in the back seat.
Not for me. I don't drive.
You don't drive?
No. I'm one of those strange people who don't drive.
Will you buy the driverless cars when they come out?
In a minute.
You would do that?
Oh, yeah. I like to get around. I just don't like to drive.
It'll be amazing how they all function and work. That's for sure. I wonder if they're good enough to be able to maneuver away from the bad driver, the bad human driver.
That would be good. I know that until that happens, I'm just going to use car services.
Oh, my gosh. Now, if people want to track you, you don't have a website, but you have a Facebook, right?
Yes, I have a Facebook page called Historian of the Strange. Be sure to visit. I post something there that's odd every single day. And you can reach me there. You can email me at robertdamonschneck@gmail.com. And, of course, the books are coming out, so you can get Bye Bye Man. You can buy it on Amazon or buy it tomorrow at Barnes & Noble or something like that. And Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist, if you like this kind of thing.
What has happened to Eli, Catherine, and Jonathan since the Bye Bye Man?
Eli is still my friend. He was the one who first came up with the idea of the Haunted House Project. Jonathan became a long-haul trucker. And Catherine absolutely refuses to have anything to do with this. She will not discuss it.
Wow.
She wants nothing to do with it. She was kind enough to give me permission. She signed a release. It took a while to track her down, but I did finally find her, and she was kind enough to sign a release, but she wants nothing to do with this.
I bet Jonathan, as a over-the-haul driver, listens to us quite a bit.
I'm sure he does. He might be listening right now.
I think so. Robert, again, until when everything else comes out, get back to us, okay?
I will, George. It'll be a pleasure.
How about that? It's going to be a movie. It's going to be a movie in December, and I'm sure it'll be called The Bye-Bye Man. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.